Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. This is podcast 360. People are asking me for update podcasts. So in this podcast, we're actually going to do some updates. You know, you've heard of Anderson Cooper 360. This is podcast 360, the Bob Davis Podcasts, the new talk. Well, the grand reopening continues at xgovernmentcars.com. They have nicer, newer vehicles. You've heard me talking all about xgovernmentcars.com actually since the beginning of the Bob Davis podcasts. You know that's where I got the ambulance for the podcast mobile command unit. And you know that xgovernmentcars.com has Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, which is the Ford police sedan, plus trucks, vans, and SUVs, Expeditions, Yukons, vehicles like that. Great financing for all levels of credit, and this is the main thing. Whether you have good, bad, or ugly credit, everybody gets approved. X Government Cars only carries one owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles. I've had four of them now, and they're awesome. And the thing is, people are starting to sell these vehicles around town, and the reality is you just never know what you're getting at those other dealers. Only xgovernmentcars.com has the experience to know where to get the good ones, as well as cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson, a three-day satisfaction guarantee. So if you don't like the car, you take it back. Financing for all levels of credit. I talked about that earlier. And you can apply online safely and securely 24/7 at
xgovernmentcars.com.
2420 Nevada Avenue North, Golden Valley, Minnesota. The grand reopening event is on now. Everything is better at
xgovernmentcars.com.
So in this podcast, you know, obviously I did a podcast consciousness podcast previously in podcast 359. I did some speaking this weekend, and as usual, all weekend long, I'm kind of continuing to scan. And I want to start with something called the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I never watch or pay any attention to. And the only thing I can understand about this is basically this originally started as a way for politicos and news media to kind of get together and give each other a hard time. And it is turning into a Dean Martin celebrity roast, which is hardly something that we should be paying attention to. Now, the news media right now is taking flack because during the White House Correspondents' Dinner this weekend, we started to have these riots in Baltimore while the grandees in Washington honored themselves or whatever. And today I'm seeing all this stuff about, well, here's how we have to fix the correspondence dinner and everything else. My suggestion is to get rid of it. That's how you fix it. What is happening is a Hollywoodization of what is supposed to be news and particularly political news. It's the sportsification, it's the sports talkification, or the Hollywoodization or the TMZization of political news. And this is what is wrong with media and Washington. And people say, well, why, you know, if they do it with sports and they do it with Hollywood, why would you be upset about it? Because people are constantly talking about how they're divided and how, you know, we're not hearing enough about issues. And the reason is we're focusing too much on these personalities. Moreover, now the news men and women are in the story. They're not just reporting on the story, they are the story. And I don't think that's good. You know, the media continues to take hits over and over again to their credibility. I don't know if it makes any difference in terms of what people think of the information that they're seeing. I will tell you, I think Brian Williams has done a lot of damage to NBC News. Looks like they're going to ask him to resign, which is what I told you would happen. And then we come to the Comcast Time Warner deal, which is kind of on the same subject. It's media. Two of the most unpopular companies in America, Comcast and Time Warner. I don't have any experience with Time Warner. I've never been a Time Warner customer, but I do have experience with Comcast, and I do have an experience and experiences with Comcast customer service, which is terrible. It is terrible even for people who, you know, have a simple thing to deal with, let alone people who have something complex. And we all know the litany of stories about terrible customer service at Comcast. Actually, I think Comcast has gotten more negative publicity than Time Warner, but you know, I don't pay attention to Time Warner stories. Well, I remember talking about that in one of the podcasts, and I said, you know, if you really are upset about Comcast's customer service, then send the FTC a message, because they have these comment periods and people can go online, go to the FTC website and comment. And apparently this is one of the things that happened, and the government started to make noise about this Comcast Time Warner deal. Notwithstanding, why is the government involved in whether or not Time Warner and Comcast could merge? But it's interesting to me that the merger is off. And the upshot of all this is, you know, when companies have really bad customer service, when they're really bad at serving their customers, regardless of whether they have, a local quote unquote monopoly or a captive market, as the cable companies do, it ends up making a big difference. So I think it's actually good news that the Time Warner and Comcast deal aren't going to happen. And as far as other good news, every time I do a podcast, I get this, well, not every time, but occasionally I see these people that write, how come you never talk about any good news? There is good news, and I'll tell you what it is. People are starting to write about how the balance of power when it comes to energy in the world is shifting. I've started to see articles on this. Bottom line is, the United States is now, if it isn't the world's largest single country producer of oil, it's very close. The first is, of course, Saudi Arabia. We're number two or number one. We may be number one already. We account for about 10% of world production today. So the United States is now suddenly the world's leading swing producer of oil. And what that does is it kills OPEC's efforts to control the price of oil, because we can produce more if they decide to cut back. And this is already having an impact on world oil markets. It's having an impact on Saudi leadership, and it's going to have a major impact on foreign policy eventually. And the thing that is really interesting about this, I think it's really important, is what makes fracking possible is technology. And the technology is getting better and better and better. And so all of the people that predicted peak oil and policy as the result of that really are wrong. And I can remember actually doing the night show on KSTP, and I remember people calling in and saying, you know, peak oil, King Hubbert. And I really didn't know anything about it. And I read up on it and I said, I don't believe this. And I never believed it. And it appears that there's plenty of oil in the world. And here's the result of this. You know, first of all, while it happened on the president's watch, it had little to do with his policies. He's actually done everything he can do to prevent oil production in America. But it's going to have an impact on foreign policy eventually. No longer will people have to say, well, that we're sending troops to the Middle East because of oil. And I think if we can continue this, if fracking in the United States and oil production in the United States proper can continue without, and I don't suggest that we do things to make it easier necessarily for that to happen. If the business continues the way that it's continuing, I think it's going to eventually produce a huge shift in foreign policy in the United States, because we won't be beholden to some of these countries in the Middle East as swing oil producers. And that's really good news. The bad news is that the left now wants to do away with huge subsidies for oil companies. Fifth District Congressman Keith Ellison in Minneapolis. So it's a Minnesota congressman, Keith Ellison, one of the sponsors of a bill that would do away with quote-unquote oil subsidies. And whenever I start talking about subsidies, I have to mention a couple things. First of all, subsidies, the technical definition of subsidy is that a subsidy is a direct cash payment to a company for a certain type of behavior. So when we talk about subsidies, what we're really talking about when it comes to the oil companies are tax breaks. So I'll talk about that in a second. But first, I think we're getting a lot more bang from our buck to begin with when it comes to subsidies for oil companies. Second, we're talking about the same kinds of tax breaks and deductions that Apple and Microsoft and all kinds of U.S. companies, large and small, take, especially manufacturing companies. So if you want to cut off the, quote, subsidies for oil companies, then you're going to be cutting off the subsidies for manufacturing of all kinds. Third, the largest expenditure, I learned this today, for energy by the federal government is $1 billion for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which I assume these people are counting as a, quote-unquote, subsidy. What it is the federal government buying buying oil for the SPR. Should we get rid of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? I don't think so. Even with all of the production, if, for example, we had an EMP strike, we would need the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And with oil so cheap right now, it's a great time to be refilling the SPR. Second largest expenditure by the federal government for quote-unquote oil subsidies is just under $1 billion, and this is tax exemptions for farm fuel. So if you're on the farm and you need diesel or gas or gasoline, you get an exemption for that. Should we get rid of that? Should we take this away from farmers? Third largest, and this blew me away, is $570 million for low-income home energy assistance, which is classified as a petroleum subsidy, quote unquote, because it artificially reduces the price of fuel, which supposedly helps the oil companies sell more of it, but it also helps these families, you know, that can't afford heating oil during the winter. This is a public relations effort by Keith Ellison and anybody else sponsoring this, since everybody loves to hate the oil companies. And there's a couple of things I want to point out. Oil companies have thin profit margins. It's feast or famine with oil companies. Certainly fracking has helped that a little bit because they can idle these wells and spin them back up a little bit more cheaply than they used to be able to do. Exploration is a little bit more cheaper, but you know, for hating the oil companies, you're dealing with businesses that don't have very wide profit margins but deal in enormous sums of money. Subsidies, again, are technically direct payments. These are tax breaks, what we're talking about, which all businesses take or which are used for quote-unquote good purposes like the home heating oil subsidy or the farm fuel subsidy. What about subsidies for wind and solar and ethanol and electric cars? These are, in fact, direct payments to rich people like Warren Buffett and Elon Musk and rich farmers in Iowa and rich people who can afford the Tesla and get the $7,500 tax credit or the tax credit for whatever, I don't know what it is, in California that's being offered, as well as the fact that Tesla makes money selling carbon credits, which was made possible through legislation. They're selling virtually nothing other than a carbon credit that was made possible, carbon credit that was made possible through legislation. You don't hear them talking about that when they want to attack the oil industry. Meanwhile, the top-selling car in the United States, well, actually, it's the top-selling GM car. I shouldn't say the top-selling car in the United States. The vehicle keeping the company afloat right now, according to some analysts, is not the gas electric. It is the Yukon, Suburban, and Escalade. And as the price of gasoline goes down, more and more people are trading their electrics in and buying these big vehicles. And it's just very interesting to me because you know, the idea is we'll make gas more expensive so people will buy electric cars, which we subsidize. It's nuts. So the war on the car continues. And the core of this podcast, I think we should devote a little bit of time to something that drives me crazy. The war on the individual continues, the war on independent government-free action continues, and the latest in this struggle is the continuing proliferation of something called light rail across this country, really rail of any kind. I don't know if I mentioned this, but desalinization is something that's very popular now being discussed in California, and my understanding is a desalinization plant for California to use seawater to help irrigate the crops, which would save a lot of water in the state, would cost less than that ridiculous rail project that Governor Jerry Brown thinks is so great that would extend from, I guess, nowhere to nowhere. I'm not quite sure, but desalinization would cost less than the train. Which do you think is more important for California at this point in time? In Minnesota, we've had our experiences with light rail as well as just straight up rail. We have something called the North Star, which is a disaster. It loses money every year and no one is riding it. And the latest in Minnesota is the Southwest Light Rail Project. This is a project. We already have two light rail lines. One extends from downtown to the airport and the other one extends from downtown St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis, running up University Avenue through the University of Minnesota all the way to downtown Minneapolis. And I just read last week that one of the biggest problems with light rail in Minneapolis on both the Hiawatha and the Green Line, that's what they call the one that goes between St. Paul and Minneapolis, is that people are not paying their fares. They get on and they ride for free and they get off. And it's a huge amount of money. And, you know, these light rail lines, whenever they're put in, do not reduce congestion. They do not produce development, because what happens is cities and states create all sorts of aid money to bring development in behind the light rail. But if you take the aid money away, they don't create the light rail, or they don't create development around the light rail. And the way that this thing all started was, first they said it would reduce traffic. Well, it didn't. So then they said, well, it's a great development tool. And I actually gave them that idea, I have to say, because I said what they really should do is sell it as a development tool. The thing is, it's not a very good development tool either. And now I don't know how they sell it. They just force it through, because it fits in with this vision of the early 20th century city as the city that should be the example. The Rosetta Stone for major cities all over America is the 20th century, the early 20th century, 1910, 1915 city, which was fed by trains because cars didn't exist, right? So in Minneapolis and St. Paul, we have something called the Southwest Light Rail. And one of the things that drives me crazy about these light rail projects is they never cost what they say that they're going to cost. They always come in over budget, and it gets worse every year. Now they say the price of the Southwest Light Rail project is going to increase by $341 million. I mean, that's a lot of money due to bad ground conditions, soil contamination in Hopkins and St. Louis Park, which is two suburbs that it has to run through, which were industrial sites years and years ago. I met a guy this weekend, and this is the reason light rail is inadvisable and why it's not advisable to spend this kind of money on it. First of all, if you could privately finance light rail, I would be for it. I think that city governments and state governments could create the right of ways for the railroads if it could be privately financed, but it will never be privately financed because it costs too much to build it, it costs too much to run it in perpetuity, and it never makes money. And this is why companies got out of the rail business back in the 1940s and 50s in the United States, and I'm talking about rapid transit all over the country. Originally in Chicago, which is one of the rapid transit, you know, rail Rosetta Stones, those railroads were originally private companies. And in the 1940s, late 40s, they became, a part, a province of the city. It was called Rapid Transit. And then later the CTA was created. And now you have the same situation in Chicago, where the CTA is a drain, a funding drain. It doesn't make money, and it costs more and more every year to maintain it. Same in New York. Eventually, it will be true as well in San Francisco with BART. And certainly it's beginning to be true with the metro in Washington, D.C., which everyone raves about. But they don't rave about the costs associated with it in terms of employees and continued upkeep. And both BART and the metro in Washington are relatively new systems because they were built in the 1970s. And these in themselves are heavy third rail projects. What we're talking about in Minneapolis and St. Paul is light rail. Well, the governor was shocked and appalled to find out that the Southwest Light Rail project is now going to cost $2 billion, which is considerably more than what was originally projected. And again, this is the statists' grand vision of the early 20th century city, in which all roads lead downtown and everybody takes the train downtown and works in office buildings downtown and then comes home in the evening to the family in the close-in either ring suburbs or in the city. I met a guy this weekend, and every time I start talking about light rail at some event, this is the kind of person that I encounter. Young guy who lives in Eden Prairie, and he works in Plymouth at Polaris. And I said, so you'll be taking the light rail. And he was like, well, I couldn't possibly do. I mean, I have to, his commute takes him around back. It doesn't, most commutes are not to downtown. And most people do not work downtown, either in Minneapolis or St. Paul. They work in the ring suburbs. They work in Plymouth. They work in Eden Prairie. They work in, you know, along the Beltway. And this is true in many, many markets in the United States today. And it's becoming more and more true, not to mention technology enables companies that used to have to use large amounts of office space, and they had big campuses, both outside of town as well as in town, do not need that much space anymore because they are laying off employees due to autonomous machines, due to all sorts of new technology. So they don't need those offices in places that they used to have to need, and their employees don't necessarily work in downtown. I give you as an example, none other than Target, that is laying off thousands of employees in the downtown office, and the plan is to move many of them to their Burnsville or St. Louis campuses, St. Louis Park campuses, because they don't need, the offices downtown are, they don't need those people, you know? And I think some of that's driven, in fact, by the employees who find having to go downtown, either by the train or the bus, becomes, you know, more and more difficult every year. The other thing, and I think this is becoming really a truism, is that, and I think the statists with their vision of the 20th century city really thought that the millennials would be the saving grace. This was the generation that they were counting on to create the creative class of hipsters living downtown and hanging out in the sidewalk cafes like they do in Westwood, in Los Angeles, and Brooklyn, and in parts of the north side of Chicago, except it isn't working out that way. New data, and I mentioned this in another podcast because really it's a surprise. There's new data which now shows millennials are moving to the suburbs and they're moving to the exurbs. It's not just the close-ring suburbs where the yoga places and the coffee places are there and there's maybe some kind of sort of, you know, bohemian lifestyle. They're moving to places way out because that's where the cheap houses are. And you can't raise kids in a condominium. It's very difficult to raise more than one child in an apartment downtown. First of all, they don't want to hang out with the tattooed women and their dogs in the outdoor coffee clutches and art crawls and the bars, and they don't want to ride the pub bike and all that stuff. Because kids want to play in the park. They want to ride the horse. They want to play in the park. They want to be outside all the time. And you can't do that when you live in an apartment downtown in an efficiency apartment that's $1,500 or a one-bedroom apartment that's $1,800 or more. I would hardly call that affordable housing. Now, there's nothing wrong with that stuff, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to live that way. But the statists have put almost all their eggs in creating tax breaks and other encouragements to build, quote, affordable housing, which it isn't downtown. Go down there and price those apartments in those really cool places. By the way, my neighbor's doing his laundry, and I'm doing these podcasts a little earlier these days, so you can hear the dryer running over there, which is cool. So you see this all over the country where they're trying to create these urban centers, and they're really cool. And I think it's great when they do it. And when you're in those urban centers, people say, isn't this great? We should have this in our town. Even Roanoke, Virginia has one, right? But when you look at the cost to produce that and to distort the market so that that happens, the question becomes, is it happening because the market wants it to happen, or is it happening because we're creating this situation where people are doing this? Certainly, I know there's a lot of retirees downtown, and I know that people think, boy, I'd like to live downtown, and that's fine. But when you're creating an infrastructure that costs billions and billions of dollars to build and to continue to run year after year after year, to force people to go downtown, which is not where they want to go, which is not where they're going to go. And as technology grows, and as we use more and more autonomous software, and as we use more and more driverless cars, and as these things become a reality of life in the next 25 to 30 years, I question whether the downtown model means anything. I think I read someplace this week that Detroit is now the first city in America that has a vertical farm. It's It's a new thing where they're converting skyscrapers in Detroit into vertical farms. And I wouldn't create subsidies for that. But the question is, what would we do with the downtown areas if people don't need to go there anymore? The other thing is, the more Mall of Americas that you have, the more of the city type developments that you have in Maple Grove, or I think it's Maple Grove, or St. Louis Park, where you've got sort of a mini entertainment center. And as those age, more and more yoga places and coffee places, and that sort of bohemian kind of environment can be created, then people don't have to go downtown. And I will tell you, as a person who lives in the West Metro, it's nice to go out and go over to the West End and go to the same places that you would go downtown and just hang out over there, maybe go see a movie and then go to a bar afterwards. And you're literally 4 minutes from home. You're not far away from home at all. And even if you're using Uber, it's the difference between a $60 ride and a $15 or a $10 ride. So people are going to take that into account, especially if they have babysitters at home, especially if, they're watching their pocketbook, which people are doing these days. So it's not surprising that that there's a cost overrun associated with the Southwest Light Rail line. It's not. What's surprising is that the governor is even shocked or appalled about it. And then he appealed to an unelected body of perfumed princes and princesses called the Met Council, with their own police department and an army of union workers that are supposed to be running these buses, trains, and other far-flung possessions of the duchy, which essentially lose money year after year. Well, not essentially. They do lose money year after year after year, no matter who rides or how many people ride or where they ride to, whether it's to see a baseball game downtown, which is usually why people ride the light rail, or even if they pay when they ride the train. If you want to, Governor Dayton, if you want to fix the price tag for the Southwest Light Rail line, cancel it, because I believe 25 to 30 years from now, we won't need the trains. They will be relics. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised to see them ripped out within 25 years. I doubt that it will happen, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did, because we're moving very rapidly into an age where technology is going to obviate a lot of these arrangements that these people who have this vision, they've grown up in the 20th century. There is a vision in the back of their mind, of an image in the back of their mind of the early 20th century as a utopia. It goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that those cities were not utopias. Chicago in 1910 was not a utopia. New York City in 1910 was not a utopia. I suppose in the early 20s was probably the golden age of Manhattan specifically, and certainly of the close in boroughs in New York, because the suburbs hadn't been built yet, because you couldn't get to Long Island. There was no way to get there. There was no Long Island expressway. There was no infrastructure to be able to get out to New Jersey too. Those were farm towns on the other side of the river. You had to take a ferry from Staten Island to Manhattan. And when you look at the golden age of Manhattan, it was, which I think actually is now in certain ways, in certain periods of time. But if you looked at the 20s as that sort of moment when Manhattan was this fantastic place, all the way from Wall Street up to Harlem, when the whole island was this amazing place, it was a much smaller city with a much smaller metropolitan area. And the same is true in Chicago and all these places. So in the back of their mind, these people who are 60 and 65, these movers and shakers, the governor and Peter McLaughlin and some of these other people who are in their late 40s, early 50s, early 70s, early 60s, in the back of their mind, they're remembering this fairy tale. Because those cities were, first of all, in the early 1900s, horses still carried ice and coal and everything else, and there was horse manure everywhere. And cities were not healthy places for poor people. I mean, the Lower East Side of Manhattan was a ghetto. So these cities were not, parts of the cities were beautiful, just like today, and there were other parts that weren't beautiful. The difference today is our cities are much bigger because we have larger populations. towns, even small towns like Roanoke, Virginia, or Des Moines, have parts of the city which are really great and parts that aren't. So the question is, should we distort the market and take money from taxpayers to build these train lines and condominiums and things like that to get people to come downtown, because somebody has this vision in their mind, when technology is running so fast ahead of that, that our cities and our states and our country is going to look totally different 25 to 30 years from now. I mean, here's one example. We were talking about this tonight at yoga, and I mean, everyone was laughing at me, but we're very close to, and by what I'm talking about is very close in scientific terms, from taking a theory of being able to create anti-aging drugs to actually creating an industry selling pharmaceuticals that will reverse aging. Literally, they've done it with mice, and they're trying to figure out how to make that leap to humans. Now, it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it may not happen in 20 years, but it could happen in 50 or sooner. When people start living to be 100 or 150, and they look like 30-year-olds, how does that change the nature of the city? But not even thinking about that, thinking about the technology that we now do have, whether it's the smartphone or communications technologies that enable, and autonomous machines that enable companies to not have to have so many people working for them. And we're seeing robotics and construction, which means that, we do see robotics and construction, 3D printing and stuff. But in manufacturing, it enables all sorts of things to be sort of broken loose from this sense of we have a city. You can build a plant in a place, where you don't have to have a large city, because if you're going to use robotic construction, you don't need it. So, I'm not sure that the city's going to look the way they imagine it. And if go to a kid and ask a kid what they imagine the future city to be, they'll talk about flying cars. They'll talk about all sorts of things that no adult alive today thinks about. And I'm just afraid that I'm not afraid of it, because I know it's happening and I know it's not going to work, but we're getting imaged into this statist idea of building a city as the center, and then all roads lead to Rome, except they don't. And I'll talk about that more in future podcasts. But we decided to do some updates for you guys, and those are some updates, some things that are going on locally as well as nationally for podcast 360, the Bob Davis podcast. This sponsored by xgovernmentcars.com. I mentioned they've got nicer, newer vehicles, but the main thing about xgovernmentcars.com is the financing. Doesn't matter what your credit is, they can get you hooked up, and they've got Chargers, Impalas, Expeditions, Yukons. Ed is great. He offers direct cash deals, 3-day satisfaction guarantee. They have financing for all levels of credit. You can apply online 24/7 at xgovernmentcars.com very safely and securely. So check out what they've got. Just go to xgovernmentcars.com or visit them at 2420 Nevada Avenue North in Golden Valley. And thanks, Ed, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Yes, I do have the bullhorn right here. Let me get it out.
xgovernmentcars.com.
And thanks to the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast, Mad K Studios. If you click on the Mad K Studios banner, it takes you to Mad K Studios' Facebook page. You can see the kind of stuff that Ken is doing. This is original automotive artwork. It's not pictures, but it's amazing work. Click on the banner at thebobdavispodcast.com for more information. Thank you for listening on Blog Talk Radio. I just put the link up on thebobdavispodcast.com. Well, Mitch put the link up, but I ordered it. As the director of sales and operations here at the Bob Davis podcast, I ordered the link to be placed on the website, and it takes a little while for it to load, but it's the Blog Talk Radio link. It's a player. It plays the last podcast that was loaded. And people have been asking me about the delay loading podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn, as well as Blog Talk. Here's the deal. We now have 360 podcasts posted at the Bob Davis podcast. These are very big audio files because I use higher quality audio. When you have lots and lots of data, when the RSS feed goes to the website, Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn, or Blog Talk Radio now, it takes a while for it to load because that's just how it is. Sometimes as much as a 48-hour delay for new podcasts, which is why we have the page. You can listen to the podcast right on the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, and I like that when you do. Thanks for liking, sharing, and favoriting, and checking out Blog Talk Radio as well. and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for your donations through that big yellow secure and safe donate button at the BobDavisPodcast.com. And thanks for listening to Podcast 360.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress, watching me get undressed, take that body downtown. I say you're the bestest, leaning for a big kiss, put his favorite perfume on.